Hello, everyone, and welcome to the third installment of our JRP podcast series. I'm the principal investigator, Nicole Blanchette, an associate professor at X University, also known as Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada. Joining me now, I've got one of our research assistants, well, pretty much our main research assistant, Sama Nemet Alla, and also from Mount Royal University in Calgary, we have Karen Owen. Hello.
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 So we are going to talk a bit today about where we've come on the research process. Our last podcasts were, I think, a year or so ago, maybe even longer. It's hard to say. It's time is both flying by and standing still. So we're going to talk a little bit about lessons learned along the way and what we found challenging. So Sama, do you want to go first?
Yeah, absolutely. I had the privilege of spending my first summer after my first year of undergraduate school of journalism at X University coding a huge mass of data. I think I ended up coding about 1,000 some stories.
A little context. In total, the Canadian team did 3,727 news stories.
Yeah. So I did about a third, which was honestly, it was incredible to dive that deep into, so much Canadian content and to analyze it. I think one of the most difficult parts for me was like ensuring uniformity between all of the other coders. So we had a couple of other coders. We had Nicole, we had Karen, we had some French coders as well. And the way that we made sure, I mean, obviously a lot of things came up, like would this be categorized as a business source, or would it be categorized as an educational source or a state source? And a lot of those things ended up being difficult, like in terms of stratification. And we dealt with that by creating really early on this coding questions document, where somebody would go in, put in a question, tag Nicole, tag others that might know of the answer. And then kind of together, we would find a way to like, what would be the best way to go about this? And that would make sure that there was like a standard, because those questions came up for everybody. So you can kind of go back and take a look at it and say like, let's read one of the questions that we have. If an article is a brief with a podcast audio embedded, do we still code the story and do the guests count as sources? And then Nicole would go in and give us this detailed, nuanced, unabridged answer of how we would go about it. And then other people could kind of go in and say, okay, this question's been answered. I know how to now make sure that my coding is accurate in terms of what my other teammates are doing.
So it was, I mean, it sounds like it would be simple going into it because you've got this code book that identifies, you know, quite clearly, these are the different types of sources. So just pick what it is. But for, as an example, for people who aren't as familiar with the codebook as we are, when we're talking about a public health official talking about the pandemic, they were actually coded as a government or government source versus a medical source or an expert source, because they were speaking for the government in that role as a public health official. So there were these different layers of picking what is the best source for this person, whatever, whoever they might be, depending on the circumstance that they were being used for within that particular story. So there were a lot of layers to think about. How is that for you, Karen?
Well, I have never read articles so deeply and thoroughly in all my life. In fact, kind of suck the joy out for a moment every once in a while when you're like, oh, I'm not just reading this to get the information. I am coding this. I'm looking for specific things. But that being said, it's actually a very interesting exercise to look at news coverage over a span of a year during a pandemic. Because I was just looking at the first newspaper I coded in January, and they were just talking about this vague disease happening in Wuhan, I believe, at that time. And little did we know, by March, we would be in the depths of this pandemic coverage, and it would permeate throughout this coding experience. So I think in some, it was a rare opportunity to do this. And so while it was a bit of a hard slog at times, it was also very, very interesting and enlightening.
And just to clarify too, so the coding, we were doing the coding over the course of 2021, but the stories that we were coding were actually from two constructed weeks in 2020. So that was spanning January to December 2020, with you know, 7 days in two constructed, in these two constructed weeks that we were looking at content for. And it was, I noticed the same thing too. In January, there were very few stories, and then February, not so many stories. And then March, basically every story had something to do with the pandemic.
And I was realizing too that, I mean, Karen, you were talking about how important of an exercise it was. I was realizing that I was basically coding every story beyond even what we were actually coding in terms of the experience. I mean, like, I was watching TV and I'm like, would I code this source as a state source or would it be a business source? My sister's like, what are you doing? But I had to do it because it just became like ingrained into the fabric of my day to day. Coding was number one priority. But that was always fun. I think I needed to take a step back and say, like, yes, we're consuming this and analyzing this, but I can also enjoy the training. I can also enjoy consuming this data.
And is it, so we were talking previously just about things we might've found a bit surprising in the stories that we were coding. So Karen, what did you find surprising about the content?
Well, one of the things we were looking for, and I'll just read part of the definition, is called the interventionist role. And it refers to a kind of journalism where the journalist has an explicit voice in the story and sometimes acts as an advocate for individuals or groups in society. So in this sense, a greater level of participation by the journalist implies higher levels of interventionism. And I thought, as a former journalist, I thought, well, I'm not going to see a lot of that in Canadian journalism. Generally, we let our sources have the opinions, offer the insight, and we just deliver the facts around our sources' opinions and perspectives. Well, gosh, if it didn't turn out that we actually do more of that interventionist type of thing than I thought we did. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it'll help inform my teaching going forward. But it was really interesting because I think I started this project with some assumptions of what I would find. And it was very interesting.
Some important context there too is what is interventionist, what makes up that interventionist role. So there are several different things that make up how that shows as performance in someone's reporting. So one of them is journalist point of view. One is interpretation. So basically some cause and effect, you know, explanation to something that might be happening. One is a call to action. Another part of that role indication is using qualifying adjectives, and another is using the first person. So those are the things that the indicators that are ranked to then come up with a score, so to speak, of when we are seeing this interventionist performance in reporting. And we know, just because we're starting the analysis now, that Canada ranked quite high in terms of other countries. In fact, I think, and Sam, you can double check for me, but I think we were third out of 37 for, again, the indication of that these roles were present, this interventionist role was present in the content that we were coding. But when we looked a little deeper at what that means, the two areas, we were pretty much in alignment with everybody else in terms of meeting the mean, but the two areas where there was a difference or interpretation and the use of qualifying adjectives. And I know interpretation was something that you saw quite a bit of, Karen.
I did. And I think partly because I was coding a newspaper, so they have the ability to write longer stories. And if we think about the inverted pyramid, a lot of that nice to know, the less important, can also be some interpretation. And I guess, I don't want to leave people with the perception that there was a lot of journalists' point of view from there actually writing, I see this or I believe this. It's nuanced. And I guess that's what we're going to have to share with when we start sharing this this data. It is nuanced and it's not cut and dry.
But again, in terms of interpretation, I think it's important what you were just talking about, Karen, that this wasn't, you know, people explicitly stating an opinion, but it was more about taking, for example, a bunch of opinions and contextualizing them and stating them without attribution. So it wasn't necessarily that they were playing the expert in something. It was more just sharing information and giving some reasoning about why something may or may not happen, for example. But the other area was the qualifying adjectives. And with that, it's interesting because we had a lot of discussions about what exactly, when are we going to code it as a qualifying adjective? And it had to be something directly related to the story. So I'm going to use my favorite example for everyone is the epic snowman story. So we have this story about a family who'd built this giant snowman and giant, I think it was 7 feet high or something in front of their house. And in the story, it was described as an epic snowman. So that was coded as a qualifying adjective because it directly described what the story was about. But again, that would have been used towards this indication that the journalist was playing an interventionist role. So we got into a discussion about, well, you know, when is an epic snowman just an epic snowman and it's a good descriptor versus that is making some kind of judgment call?
Yeah, I think the conclusion we came to is so much of this is just rooted in subjectivity. And it was like impossible as journalists to step so completely outside of your story. Sometimes a fact is a fact. An epic snowman is an epic snowman. And sometimes the ways that we perceive things will bleed into a story inevitably. And as somebody who was really new to journalism at the beginning of this, that was a really interesting conclusion to be able to come to and to say that I can bring this to my learning and I can bring this to the way that I approach my journalistic practice in the future.
And yeah, and it's something that wasn't sort of an epic snowman, it's an epic snowman, and that's not, you know, making sort of a judgment call. I was just sharing, this was a, actually I sent this picture in a text to Karen over the summer when I was coding, because it was such a good example of a string of qualifying adjectives. And it's from a newspaper article and says, facing a pandemic budget apocalypse, Toronto City Council members are loath to consider obvious areas for cuts, arguing that the least painful targets would not save enough money to dent the city's colossal problem. So there's an instance where those are some pretty hard hitting qualifying adjectives.
And for our English students out there, that's also a hyperbole.
So other interesting things that we discovered: Canadian journalists use expert sources more than other countries, apparently. It was interesting when we first sent our data in, the lead on the international project called me and just said, you know, I just want to double check sources because you seem to be using a lot more in terms of expert sources than comparatively internationally. And I was pretty surprised, actually. I thought, that's interesting because the stories I was coding, I didn't see what I expected would be, an unusual percentage of expert sources. But to give you an example, Canada compared globally. So in the health stories that we had coded, 40% of those stories had an expert. On the international, like using all 37 countries that were involved in the study, that was only 21.8% of stories that used an expert in the stories that were coded as health stories. For non-health stories, we had 23% of them had experts, and internationally that was 12.34%. So we were pretty much double use of sources. And we actually, was something we kind of went back and looked at, and we just used a lot of sources, again, comparatively, because in my mind, speaking as someone who used to work in a newsroom who teaches other people, you know, what they're going to do when they go out to work in the world, you know, only having 40% of stories with an expert, I was thinking was kind of, maybe we need a few more experts there. So maybe that is a really Canadian thing in terms of we want an expert to give analysis or opinion or whatever it might be on a particular topic. But when I think about putting a story together, again, for how I would advise a student to do it in a newsroom, I would always be thinking of who is an expert source. And I don't know if Karen, because you worked for a long time at CTV before becoming an instructor or a teacher or professor, I guess we are at this point, if you felt that way as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think we, and maybe the expert sources are more open to speaking with us. Often we would have both too. We'd have the expert source. I did a lot of medical reporting. So we'd have the expert source, and then we'd have what many newsrooms call the real person, the citizen talking about their personal experiences as a way of telling the story, personalizing it. And it was never, it was a nice combination. You don't expect, say, a patient with a certain disease process to be an expert in the disease process. I want them just to tell me about their experience. But I would defer to the expert, the medical expert in that disease process, to make sure I've got the facts straight, to make sure we are on the right track in terms of perhaps reporting new research. So to me, it does make sense. And so perhaps that's inherently a Canadian journalist type of approach. It also makes sense, of course, during a pandemic, when we were all trying to figure out what was going on and what exactly we should be doing, to consult the experts. And may I say, we've seen what happens when people don't consult the experts, but perhaps just the worldwide interweb, and find some fake news. So I actually think it's really important they were consulting experts during the pandemic.
I was going to add that the code book, how the code book actually defines experts, which is that it refers to an informative source that's consulted as a specialist in their specific area. So depending on the actual story, that would be different. An expert source for one story could just be an actually regular citizen for another. So again, that was up to the reader, the person who's coding, to decide.
Yeah. And that was usually one that was pretty easy to identify, given the structure of the story as well. Yeah, there were a lot of tricky elements. And again, when you're talking about thousands of stories as well, all kinds of things can come up. But I think in the end, it was, if I ever have to do this type of coding again with a big team of coders, we ended up having 10 people coding throughout the process too. So one of the challenges from my perspective, as a principal investigator, I would say, is every time new people would come on is a bit of a training process, getting them up to speed, doing some testing to make sure that everyone again was coding in a way that ensured we'd have consistency of results. But it was just a lot of information. And again, the shared document and team meetings and discussions, and the fact that we had this code book that we could go back to and say, okay, let's just look at the code book. What does it say in the code book? Did help. And now we've, after the coding of thousands of stories, now we've got our 3,727, but internationally, there are close to 150,000 stories that were collected around the world from these 37 countries. So the data that we have is, it's pretty extensive. And part of the challenge now is just figuring out what of all of this information, like which areas are we going to explore? And some of the areas are the ones we've been talking about. So our use of experts, the interventionist role, and how our style of Canadian journalism, indicates that we see a lot of this role in what we're producing. So it's going down to the layers of where do we want to look at, and what are the things that we're finding interesting. And we'll also, we're actually, all of us that are in this podcast are presenting at the Canadian Communication Association conference that's upcoming. And we'll be talking about some of the things that we've been discussing, but also the challenges of working in international projects. We have some French-English comparisons too, because we had French sites of study and English sites of study. So there's just a lot of information to go through. So we'll call that. Any last thoughts to share on our podcast here before we sign off, Sam and Karen?
I'm honestly really excited to, we've been jumping in. We've been in it for a really long time, but Nicole, you were saying how much information there is. I think it can be overwhelming, but I think on the positive end of it, there is a lot to sift through. And that's such a privilege to be able to say, like, look at all of this content that we are able to analyze, and we're able to make connections from, and not just within Canada, but internationally. And I'm looking forward to that.
And I also think it's really important that we acknowledge, and this will help acknowledge and demonstrate to our students and journalists, that the role of the journalist continues to change and evolve. And what we're doing now, how we're producing stories, is not what we did 20 years ago or 50 years ago. And change is not necessarily bad. It's just interesting. And I'm actually really enjoying this process of now that I'm no longer in a journalism field, but teaching, just looking into it in through a different lens.
Yeah, I think that also coming first from a newsroom and then looking at this from more from a research lens, it is really interesting to take a look at what you think you know and that you know from one perspective and really turn that on its head and examine it in a much more clinical manner than you normally would and challenge some of those assumptions. So we will have more of these podcasts talking about these interesting things that we're finding out and our challenges with, again, dealing with this huge data set and figuring out what parts of this we need to pull out and dissect. So thank you, Sama, and thank you, Karen, for joining me not only for this podcast, but on this research journey that we have been on for quite some time now. And we will talk with you all again.